Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on December 2, 2017. This is the second in a series of talks on understanding the three marks of existence: impermanence, anicca, the not-self characteristic, anatta, and ongoing disappointment, or dukkha. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So today's talk is the second of a series of three or four or five or six or seven. I'm not quite sure. I always get in trouble when I say it's going to be three talks or four.
Not really trouble, just you're not
rich. Yeah, so I guess I'm a bad predictor of how long I can talk.
So.
We started last week with a talk on, well, the series of talks is on the three marks of existence of anicca, impermanence, anatta, the not-self characteristic, and dukkha, the unsatisfactory and disappointing experiences that follow from a misunderstanding of the first two. So the three marks of existence define the common human experience when that human life is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. You hear me say it nearly every class. The Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that it was ignorance of Four Noble Truths that led to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, disappointment, unsatisfactory experiences, in a word, ongoing suffering. A lot of the Buddhist teachings are grouped into numbers. In fact, there's a section in the Pali Canon that is just devoted to the reference by number. In other words, the Buddha gave a singular teaching or a teaching with two subjects, which is the Book of Twos, or three subjects, which is the Book of Threes. And so the three marks of existence relates directly to the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Greed, aversion, and deluded thinking arise from a misunderstanding of the first three, of anicca, anatta, and dukkha. I got you really confused, aren't I? The point that I'm making about talking about the numbers is simply to say that the Buddha taught the contextual understanding of everything that he would teach in his first teaching on another number, the Four Noble Truths. And as you break down these individual components, in other words, anicca, anatta, and dukkha, the three marks of existence, could be characterized simply by the last reference, meaning dukkha. Dukkha describes the interaction between impermanence and a misunderstanding of self, the not-self characteristic. But in breaking it down, breaking these concepts down to their components, we're able to now gain an understanding of it. So if it was enough to say, for the Buddha to say, dukkha occurs, and then he went on his merry way, he would have accomplished absolutely nothing, right? But his first teaching was that dukkha occurs. And then everything that he taught for the next 45 years of his life, this awakened human being was devoted to teaching an understanding of dukkha, of suffering. It's such an obvious thing to all of us. We all know that at times in our lives, there's stress. Another word for dukkha is stress. There's even some very useful courses that have been developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn related to the nature of stress. There is stress. But why does it take the teachings of an awakened human being to understand our own contributions to stress? Because of the second noble truth of craving and clinging. Once we create an identity, and this leads to the not-self characteristic, once we create an identity rooted in wrong views or views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we are then self-compelled to continue those views. Another way of saying that is we'll create very intricate and very powerful strategies to ignore our own ignorance through craving and clinging to those initial wrong views, to that initial ignorance. But again, the Buddha didn't stop there. He said, wait a minute, the third noble truth is cessation of this process is possible. Meaning, I can show you a way through the Dhamma to stop, to bring wisdom to where there was once ignorance, in your minds, in an individual mind. Again, this is not a global teaching in the context that everyone will understand it, although it would be a great thing for everybody to do that, but it is a very individual and personal experience. And that leads to the Eightfold Path. Because it's not a philosophy so much, meaning that if you follow a certain set of rules. Just as an example, follow the Ten Commandments. You're going to be good to go when you die. The Buddha didn't care about what happens after we're dead. He was concerned about the quality of human life in this moment, in this human life. And so another number, the Eightfold Path, breaks down the components of craving and clinging and ignorance into a form that we can recognize it. And we recognize it directly through eye-making, anatta, the second mark of existence. So again, taking the initial problem of dukkha, one word, and now breaking it down and expanding it into its component parts allows us to see it much more clearly, because then we can no longer ignore our own ignorance when we see it in this very clear way. So last week we looked at impermanence, the impermanent nature of all things, and I talked about when the Buddha gave his first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, I love that word. After giving that teaching, Khandana so understood it, he penetrated the nature of suffering to its core that he declared all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And the Buddha said, you are now Anakandana, the one who understood. In the very first teaching, another human being gained the awakened state, gained full human maturity, just as the Buddha had done a few weeks prior to that. Understanding that all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation is understanding impermanence in the context of the three marks of existence. And the reason why I say that is I've gotten this question or comment more than a few times from students. You know, I don't think it's ever come up in here, but on online class. Why are you emphasizing impermanence? I understand impermanence. Everything is impermanent. And we all know that on a surface level, don't we? That nothing stays the same and things change constantly. But because we are misidentifying ourselves and the impermanent nature of all things, we don't understand the true nature of impermanence and how the nature of impermanence leads to suffering. And it's because of ignorance that we seek to establish a permanent self in an impermanent environment. It simply can't be done. And yet once we've established through craving and clinging any self-identification with the outer world, meaning the defining ourselves by what we like and what we dislike, what we think we need to make, we need to hold on to make ourselves happy and need to avoid any type of disappointment, once we've done that, we've created an identity, haven't we? Another word for that is a self-referential ego self. Our views are now rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are, meaning the impermanent nature of all things. And we attempt to create an identity, a self, by the reference to the external world. Is that clear? And the first reference, or the initial reference that begins the process, that begins the problem, is the external reference of ourselves as this permanent body. In other words, now I've established this body as me, and it's a permanent body. Does everybody kind of understand? I know that's a pretty subtle concept to understand, but does everybody kind of get that? The self, referencing yourself in relation to your body, that this is me? And because this physical body is always in a constant process of changing, or another word of saying is of becoming, therein lies the stress, because we're trying to establish a permanent self in a vehicle that itself is impermanent. Lorna gets it. and the not to put words in your mouth, but I think you're laughing at the absurdity of the whole idea, aren't you?
Yeah.
And that leads to the absurdity of trying to establish a permanent self in an environment that cannot support it. It's just foolish. This is what the Buddha awakened to. The three marks of existence. Is everybody following me so far? Okay, let me... just getting back to that idea of the way the Buddha taught, this brilliant way of breaking things down and categorizing them in a way subjectively that we can recognize the eye-making in it. So again, greed, aversion, and delusion, the three defilements that result from a misunderstanding of the three marks of existence, could be simply characterized by the third, by deluded thinking. Greed and aversion arise from deluded thinking. The three defilements are often taught as greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Deluded thinking is the same thing as thinking rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are, isn't it? A good example, or maybe a silly example, but I'll give it anyway, is hoping to develop an understanding of how to change your oil, and the teacher hands you an orange and says, peel it. You're going to do something, and you might even understand the process of peeling an orange, and you might even understand what you're getting at tastes pretty good. Doesn't do you any good as far as understanding how to change your oil, does it? But many of us would rather substitute a nice, sweet-tasting orange than actually doing the work of developing an understanding of how to change your oil. Most of us would rather continue engaging in distraction. Another way of saying that is engaging in behavior that would allow us to ignore our own ignorance so that we don't have to learn how to change our own oil. So we can spend our life, and many people do this, in seemingly holistic or even spiritual engagements and never get to the point of eye-making. Again, getting back to how the Buddha taught this brilliant way of breaking things down in a component way so that we can understand them. In a broad sense, you could say in a macro sense, but also in the micro sense, and how to actually apply these understandings. So again, going back to how I started today's talk, the Buddha awakened, said there is dukkha, and then just went on his merry way. What good is it? But yet he spent the rest of his life breaking things down to their component parts, leading to today's talk on, not that I haven't started today's talk. This is why these talks go on.
Was that the introduction?
Yeah, maybe I should make it the talk, and we'll continue this next week. Leading to the importance of this second component of the three marks of existence, understanding anatta. When the Buddha used the term anatta, that was a common word during the Buddha's time. But the Buddha used it in a way that was completely contradictory to the way other people were using it. He was using common verbiage so that people could relate to the word, but also using the word to show that your usage and your understanding of anatta is wrong. It's a wrong view. And that's what anatta means, as the Buddha used it. That we're creating a self based on wrong views. Let go of the self. Let go of those views. They do not constitute a self. They are not a self. They're not self-characteristic. Okay? So continuing in the article, if you're reading along with me, I'm skipping ahead a little bit. And then I'll comment on this as we go along. The wisdom of the Dhamma shows the foolishness to cling an identity to a form that is impermanent and insubstantial and prone to confusion and stress. This mental physical form, rooted in ignorance, acquires the characteristics that craving directs it towards through seeking sensory satisfaction. So once we've created an identity of the physical self as who and what I am and all that I am, I'm now interpreting the enjoyment or lack of life through that identification. And we do that through our senses, don't we? Our contact with the external world is through our five senses and that sixth sense of consciousness. But remember that what I'm talking about is not a grand cosmic consciousness. It's ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. So we're interpreting the pleasure and even effectiveness of our own life through contact interpreted by that consciousness that is rooted in ignorance. And so only thing that can follow from that is ongoing stress through that misidentification of this is who I am and this is all that I am. Is that clear? If there's any questions about this while I'm going along, just raise your hand. We'll discuss all this later. Clinging establishes and maintains this form by holding on to sensory fulfillment. Remember when we talked about dependent origination, that sixth or seventh link, about craving gives rise to clinging and maintaining, and then clinging and maintaining gives rise to becoming, and that ambiguous part of dependent origination. But we know through, we talked about this a lot, you might not have gotten this part. the ambiguous part of becoming then leaves the question is, what am I going to become? Am I going to become a self continued rooted in ignorance, or will I become awakened? And so right before that is clinging and maintaining. We've created views now that are rooted in ignorance, and I'm clinging and maintaining those views. Unless something intervenes, unless we develop something individually to interrupt that process, we can only continue becoming more ignorant and continue a life rooted in that ignorance. Is that clear? That's the essence of I-making in that section of dependent origination. Complete development of the Eightfold Path brings release from that process of continued I-being. It's the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, for no other reason except to recognize and abandon views rooted in ignorance. And it takes the entire Eightfold Path, rooted in the concentration developed in meditation, to achieve that goal. Through understanding the environment in which the ego personality is established and maintained, all views of self can be recognized and abandoned. Through recognition and right intention, all views of self are then abandoned. It takes that we talked about this the last couple of weeks in different classes. It takes that right intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging that gives rise to awakening, and then supported by the other factors of the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path develops understanding and profound right view. Right view is understanding the truth of stress and the impermanent environment in which the ego self is established and maintained. When the Buddha described an awakened human being in the context of right view, he said that right view is a view that completely or profoundly penetrates dukkha. It understands stress. Meaning, again, that fine point, but understanding the entire broad picture of stress and all of the components of it. The ego personality is associated with a physical form that is interpreted through consciousness. This combination of consciousness's form is known as nama-rupa, N-A-M-A-R-U-P-A. Nama-rupa means name and form. So name and form simply means that I've given a name to this form. This is John. But because I'm interpreting my experience even with my own form, conditioned thinking embellishes the way that I experience even myself. So if somewhere along the line I get the idea that I am taught from my environment that it's best to be 6 feet or taller, that you're more attractive to the world that way, and you find yourself 5'7", you're going to think less of yourself in some way. It might not be a devastating thought, but when you start adding that up to other ways that you create an identity, that I should be part of a certain social strata, upper middle class seems to be best in this world, we look at it that way, I should have a certain type of skin color, I should be a certain sex. Look what's coming out. I'm not going to get into it, but look what's coming out today, finally, in the world. I should be this, I should be that, I should have this, I should have that. I should have a Porsche because that's better than a Volkswagen. They both do the same thing. We create identities based on this idea, or based on the foolish idea of identifying ourselves with external objects, events, views, and ideas. That's the essence of I-making. It's the essence of getting to this nama-rupa, name and form. And once I start establishing myself as this form, then I have to start attaching things to myself, to define this self. And hopefully I come up with a scenario that defines this self, rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are, that defines this self better than every other self. And that begins the competitiveness within myself and within most all beings that leads to ongoing stress. Dukkha occurs. Because you can never satisfy a self-referential self. And the sole reason you can't is because that self-referential self attaches itself to things that are all impermanent. and it creates the ongoing grasping. Another word for grasping is craving. Grasping after self-referential views. I'm this, I'm that, I need this, I need that. Is that clear? That's the profound understanding of what the Buddha awakened to. Remember, when he left the palace grounds and he had everything any human being could want within those grounds, and he found the palace grounds, he found his life, he described it as a confining place, and he finally had to leave at the age of 29. He couldn't stand it anymore. So much so that he snuck out under the darkness of night. And he got into the village and he saw the village for the first time clearly. Up until that time, whenever the Buddha left the palace grounds, it was always planned. It was like going on a state visit to China. Until this last president went there, you never saw the Forbidden City. You only saw what they wanted you to see. The Buddha only allowed his son to see the world the way that the king wanted his son to see, for somewhat understandable reasons. He had a feeling and was told so that that your son's either going to be a great political leader or he's going to be a great spiritual teacher. And the king was concerned that if the Buddha saw the suffering in the world, he would want to find a solution to it. So whenever the Buddha left the palace grounds, it was always in a very careful and planned way. So for the first time, the Buddha saw life as it really was. He saw a man on the side of the road dead, and he asked Chanda, his handler, why is that man sleeping on the side of the road? And he said, he's not sleeping, he's dead. And it so shocked the Buddha. He said, what do you mean? The Buddha had never even confronted death up until that point. And Chanda says, well, that happens to everyone. That initial thought, you could say that it shattered young Siddhartha's mind. Because he started thinking, if we all end up like that poor man on the side of the road, what's the point of anything? And then he walked into town and he saw the competitiveness and the aggressiveness of people just trying to stay alive and to maintain their position in the world. And I'm shortening the story somewhat. And it was these initial experiences with recognizing the unsatisfactory nature of life that set young Siddhartha on his quest for understanding. Is there a way to understanding the nature of suffering, and how do we can we bring this to an end? How do we contribute to our own suffering? And after 6 years of arduous study and practice with some of the most advanced spiritual teachers, he came to this understanding that it is a misunderstanding, it is ignorance of these three marks of existence. Now, relate that back to the first thing that got Siddhartha going, the impermanent nature of human life. In many of the suttas, he teaches that when you profoundly understand the impermanent nature of all life, you'll take to the Dhamma, because what's most important? The last teaching the Buddha ever gave in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he finished his life's teaching with these words. Impermanence and decay is relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. He could have said anything else, couldn't he? But he pointed it right back to the importance of understanding the impermanent nature on a personal level. Not on an impersonal level. Sure, everything is impermanent. And apply it directly to our own thoughts, our own ideas, our own physical experience. This is definitely going to be a 7. Name and form. So name and form is a conscious identity or identification as an ego personality. And this is the mental or psychological factor of ego self and rupa or form. It's the thoughts we hold about ourselves. We define ourselves. This is my name. John is. This, and this. This mental physical self is an aggregate of 5 impermanent phenomenal aspects that together comprise what is called the self. I'm referring to the 5 clinging aggregates now, the ongoing personal experience of dukkha. There is nothing permanent about any individual aspect of the 5 aggregates or in a combination of all 5. Those 5 physical aggregates, known as the 5 clinging aggregates, are form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness. So those 5 aggregates are what we use in a self-referential way by clinging them together to say, this is me. And it is by clinging that together, my physical form, this physical form that has feelings, and as a result of the feelings and the disturbance in my mind that the feelings cause, I create perceptions about the world. That leads to fabrications or assumptions, meaning what I assume I need to be happy. Remember, assumptions is something rooted in false views or fabrications. And that fifth component or that fifth aggregate of consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And if you look at these closely, and it takes a little bit of investigation, but it is these five aggregates that we use to define ourselves and to interact with the world. And once we cling these aggregates together as a self, trying to create a permanent self in an impermanent environment, ongoing greed, aversion, and deluded thinking is now established. And unless something is developed to interrupt that process, we're going through our life as five clinging aggregates, as a personal experience of suffering. Is that clear? Even the idea of five clinging aggregates, the difficulty with that is it's something that we're very unfamiliar with. So we have a hard time applying those simple words to ourselves. And again, the Buddha used the five clinging aggregates simply to say, look at this. This is the ongoing personal experience of suffering, or the ongoing individual experience, five clinging aggregates. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing thinking. When you look at that within yourself in an objective way, you can see how each one of those components come into play to establish a self. And it might not be all of them all at once. Sometimes it's consciousness rooted in ignorance, the fifth component. Meaning we're protecting ideas and ideology that I've identified with. Or it might be a common feeling of anger arises, and the perception then is I need to find blame for this anger. Who's making me angry? What's making me angry? Or that ongoing assumption that this is me, Nyama Rupa. The Buddha's teaching on what constitutes a self has taken on confusing and misleading esoteric, magical, and mystical interpretations. Anatta means not self and refers to that which is to be abandoned through understanding and developing the Four Noble Truths. Rather than establishing the self in some other realm, whether it's a physical or mystical realm, or trying to create a doctrine of eye-making that results in an inner Buddhahood or inner Buddha nature, which is what has developed in modern Buddhism. And I'm not putting that down, but it is important to differentiate between what the Buddha taught and what has developed since his time. Anything that's used to establish a self in any realm, a permanent self, in any idea, in any event, is prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. It's rooted in ignorance. Anatta, let go of the views. And that anatta refers to that which is to be abandoned through understanding and develop the Four Noble Truths. It would be and is confusing to attempt to describe a concept of self without the context of developing an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. The reason why that's true, the reason why we need the framework of the Eightfold Path in order to understand what a self is because without that context and without that framework, all that we're doing is creating additional concepts and context to establish a self in. And you could say that a lot of the later developed Buddhist traditions have done just that. They found ways around recognizing and abandoning self-referential views and continued doctrines that allow to ignore its own ignorance. And again, I'm not putting it down. I know that what I've just said is a pretty harsh statement and can easily be taken as a condemnation, but I just don't mean it that way. It's important to understand that what the Buddha taught is something different and unique than anything that was ever taught before and anything that has followed, because he remained focused on Four Noble Truths and never taught anything outside of it. He remained focused on teaching and understanding of how we create a self that is prone to suffering and how to abandon that process, how to become awakened rather than become more ignorant. And I just want to make this point a little bit more, and I think we'll conclude for today. But this is an important point. Some Buddhist practices do just that by overemphasis on conceptual notions of not-self, nothingness, and emptiness, and creating mystical connotations to non-self rather than not-self. One example of this is the modern notion of an inner or obscured Buddha nature that spontaneously arises following sufficient effort. And I was a member of a particular Buddhist religion that teaches us that. If you meditate long enough, hard enough, with enough intensity, eventually Buddha nature is going to arise. The problem with that is twofold. One is the Buddha never taught that there's any such thing as an inner Buddha nature. And I remember thinking about this many years ago and being confused by it and finally coming to grips with it, that if there's such a thing as an inner Buddha nature within me, how did I get so confused and deluded in the first place? And then what good is it chasing that so-called Buddha nature if it's prone to confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering? It isn't. And that's why the Buddha never taught there's any inner Buddha nature within these wrong views of self. They're just wrong views. So what arises during a properly applied Dhamma practice, meaning a practice framed by the Eightfold Path, is recognizing and abandoning all views rooted in ignorance. And it really is that simple. So any practice that would encourage creating conceptual repositories for a self can only continue that confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering, right? And this is something that the Buddha taught during his lifetime, that during his lifetime contradicted the prevalent spiritual teachings of his time as well. Most of those were rooted in the Vedas, the precursor to modern Hinduism, that the Buddha studied and mastered and realized that just led to continued eye-making. And when he describes those teachings in two particular teachers, he says basically just that. One of the teachers was Alara Kalama, who taught this teachings founded in the Vedas, but interpreted his own way, that lead to the establishment of a self in a realm that Alara Kalama described as the realm of nothingness or emptiness, which is what some of the modern Buddhist schools seek to develop. That realm of nothingness or emptiness, the Buddha saw as just as delusional as any other self, just as delusional as identifying the self as a permanent physical body. There's nothing advanced in developing these so-called advanced mind states. The other teacher was Udeka Ramaputta, who taught this practice that culminated in an understanding of neither perception nor non-perception. Sounds very magical and mystical too. Also sounds very contradictory. It's also something that the Buddha realized is just as mundane and prone to suffering as any other self-establishment. Trying to establish a self in any of these conceptual realms doesn't work. There is nothing that can be shown to have any permanence, including a Buddha nature or Buddhahood, residing within an impermanent ego personality. There is no teaching of the Buddhas that seeks to uncover a hidden Buddha nature or latent Buddhahood. That's not to say that Buddha is not teaching how to awaken, but how to awaken by letting go of all wrong views that would seek to establish a self. There's a reference here to some other Buddhist schools, and I'm going to jump over right now. These notions in general only serve to establish the ego self in a conceptual realm that is also subject to further confusion and suffering. The refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path brings an understanding of all impermanent views and ideas rooted in ignorance. Awakening brings the end of deluded views. Let me skip over that too. I can't. This is too important. In modern Buddhism, misunderstanding the process for how all things in the phenomenal world are interconnected has led to a subtle but distraction-causing overemphasis on interconnectedness. Now remember the idea in dependent origination of craving and clinging, maintaining suffering, maintaining ignorance. Creating a doctrine that we are all interconnected or all interdependent or all one being is an extreme example of clinging, isn't it? And that's not to say that there's not some truth to the physical nature of interconnectedness, meaning that, always like a Carl Sagan used to say, we're all star stuff. We know, physicists have shown, that way back in time, a star exploded and eventually everything coalesced to what we now have as physical beings, physical human beings. So in that sense, there's an essence of the entire universe in every one of us. We're connected that way. But that connection has no bearing at all on developing an understanding of the Buddha's teachings. What he taught is to see the discrete arising of all phenomena, not to cling it together through one doctrine that seeks to establish one thing or one human being. Because it is in the individual arising of individual human beings that we start clinging wrong views to. So saying that it's true that on one physical level we're all connected, that's true. It's like saying that an orange has orange skin. It's true. But it doesn't help in bringing understanding, does it? So why worship that idea? It's not helpful. And again, I'm putting a lot of emphasis on this today because this is an underlying aspect of modern Buddhism, but also modern and not so modern thought that insists on this non-dual doctrine of everything is one thing. It's not, at least as far as the Buddha's teaching. He's teaching to understand the discreteness of all phenomena. It's so important. It doesn't negate or diminish in importance the fact that we're all part of a human family. In fact, when you start to really understand the nature of suffering, true compassion for other human beings arise, and it's informed with wisdom, with truly understanding the process of suffering arises. Due to the nature of how an ego self arises and perceives, all objects are interconnected, but all objects are also impermanent and insubstantial. So why create a doctrine, even a cosmic universal doctrine, of overemphasizing this interconnectedness? It's all impermanent. We're promoting a doctrine rooted in ignorance of impermanence then. Creating a conceptual and false doctrine of interconnectedness, interdependence, or interbeing only fosters clinging and promotes additional confusion, delusion, and suffering. The Buddha consistently avoided the myriad attempts at establishing anatta in endless conceptual realms, as this would prove a distraction to his stated purpose. Not-self simply refers to an insubstantial and impermanent ego personality that is mistaken as a substantial and permanent individual identity. Rather than creating a distracting and misinformed doctrine of nothingness or emptiness, the Eightfold Path brings understanding of the process of giving birth to an impermanent ego self rooted in ignorance and prone to endless confusion and suffering. And this presents a clear and practical path of developing profound wisdom of the continuity of unconditioned mindful experience. So I think that's a good place to end. The continuity of unconditioned mindful experience. What that means is once we have freed ourselves of conditioned mind, of views rooted in ignorance, then that unconditioned mind is free to experience life as life occurs without any self-referential view. Another way of saying that is a stress-free life. A life that is lived moment by moment without the need for it to be any different than what is occurring. And we developed a profound understanding of the difference between acceptance and approval. We no longer have to approve everything that arises in reference to mental fabrications or assumptions of what I've made of myself. And we accept it because it's what's occurring. It's just practical. Why do I accept what's occurring? Because it's what's occurred. It cannot be changed. But I can certainly attempt to alter my experience by it if I'm rooted in wrong views. I like this, I don't like that. And that is the underlying aspect of ongoing stress and disappointment. When we understand that we are, as human beings, constantly in a process of becoming, rather than constantly in a process of trying to establish a self that we've already become, rooted in wrong views, constantly in the process of becoming, then the potential of each moment is recognized as a potential to awaken. And it keeps us focused on the framework of the Eightfold Path by understanding these three marks of existence. So next week, and maybe for a couple more weeks, we'll get a little bit deeper into not-self and then start exploring the nature of how dukkha arises. And then we'll conclude this. So that's the end of this morning's talk. Thank you. Any questions about this talk? And then we'll go around the room. Anthony.
I think I heard you say that there's no such thing as a Buddha nature.
Yes.
Okay. I thought when I heard that that the Buddha nature that we have is sort of linked to compassion, because there's so much science behind how we're hardwired to want to do things for other people and how good we feel when we do things for other people. Like if you hold the door for someone,
yep,
you feel good. And so I thought that was our Buddha nature.
Compassion
is our Buddha nature.
You can call it that. You know, if you want to put that in, usually the inference of an inner Buddha nature is a component of self that arises from a particular type of effort or gaining merit. And you have to look at that closely. If I'm thinking that there's this Buddha nature, this aspect of myself within me, just that thought is establishing I'm making, and clinging to that idea will prevent recognizing and abandoning all views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So again, the Buddha never taught any notion that there's an inner Buddha nature. And the idea of compassion, most all human beings have a tendency towards compassion. We want to be helpful towards others. Usually we get caught up in fractioning that to maybe just family and friends and people we know and people to think like us. But we have an inner drive to be compassionate, unless we have some kind of psychopathology. And even people that are deeply psychotic can eventually reclaim that part of themselves. But it's not compassion alone. The Buddha didn't teach just to be compassionate and you're good to go. In fact, he referenced himself prior to his awakening in this way. When I was an unawakened bodhisattva, and what he is referring to was a human being that was endowed and inspired by great compassion, but lacking the wisdom of the way things truly are. And so to take the notion that who I am right now has this inner Buddha nature, this bodhisattva nature, then leads my whole Dhamma practice to continue to maintain this self because there's something worthwhile in it. Rather than recognizing this simple teaching that it's my views rooted in ignorance that cause the problem.
More than that there's no Buddha identity.
Pardon me?
You mean more that there's no Buddha identity.
It's better to say, to simply recognize that the views that I'm using to constitute a self are wrong views. And how do I develop right views, or right view, is through the Eightfold Path. Again, so the Buddha never ever taught. Another common aspect of most modern Buddhist schools is the idea of the Bodhisattva. In fact, all of the Mahayana schools are founded in that idea of a Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is someone who takes a vow to delay his own awakening until all sentient beings are awakened. It sounds wonderful, doesn't it? It sounds like the most selfless act. But it's a very subtle strategy to continue to elevate the self to some time of salvific form. And it denies the First Noble Truth. Suffering occurs not because there's not enough bodhisattvas in the world. Suffering occurs because it's the nature of human life. And to take on the role that I can solve all the suffering in the world by simply not awakening myself is foolish, isn't it? And if the Buddha thought that way, he would have stopped when he saw the dead guy on the side of the road. Because he had that great compassion even at that time. But he realized that that wasn't enough. There's something lacking. There's lacking the understanding of the nature of suffering. Not just the desire to end it. How can we end anything if we don't understand it? How can we change the oil if we don't understand anything but how an orange tastes? We can't do it. We have to take to the Dhamma and develop it. That's why I say often here in class, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all other sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. That's what the Buddha did. The Buddha was prior to his awakening, he was in a position to be of great benefit if he ascended to his father's throne, wasn't he? But he knew that that wasn't enough. That was just continuing ignorance. And his father happened to be a very great and compassionate ruler. He understood it wasn't enough. He understood something was missing. It's what brought us all here to class this morning. We're all living relatively comfortable and pleasant lives, aren't we? But we also recognize that something's missing. Where is this inner feeling of disappointment or unease coming from? Why do I act out in ways that at times I'm kind of embarrassed? Why do I have trouble sleeping at night or sitting quietly? Why? It's because of a lack of understanding. Four Noble Truths. Thank you for the great question. Again, sorry for the going on too long. Any other questions about this? And we'll go around the room briefly. Margaret, good to see you again. How's your practice going?
It's going. I have to admit that this week I failed in every way to apply this. And the anxiousness that's coming from... So the struggle that I'm having is recognizing this is a self-prep. This is focusing on me.
Yep. Yep. Entirely.
While this world... events are happening that are troubling.
Yeah.
And especially in this country. So that's where I'm...
And it seems... It can seem very selfish, isn't it? That how can I do this when there's so much trouble in the world? And that really is something common that comes up. In fact, people that criticize the Buddhist teaching say that it's so selfish. Until you understand what the Buddha is actually teaching and where our true responsibility lies, there's not much that I can do about... The situation in the world today is very, very similar to the situation during the Buddha's time. The only real difference was the global understanding of the troubles of the world. But the same problems were the same, and they're described and arise through an understanding of Four Noble Truths. So the nature of the world is dukkha. The nature of individual people is dukkha, meaning disappointing, unsatisfactory, prone to suffering. The nature of the world is sustained by deluded thinking. So what can I do to have a truly profound, or maybe not so profound, what can I do to have even a minimal effect on that? What's the one thing I can do? Is to not contribute to it anymore through my own misunderstanding. And so the most loving thing I can do for myself and for the entire world is to awaken. And in that way, I can contribute in a truly useful way. In that way, I'll be becoming more peaceful, more at ease, less prone to cause strife in the world. I will have the ability to gain control of my own thinking and my own actions in a very profound and useful way. So the initial understanding that there's too much going on in the world, there's too much suffering in the world, it's too selfish for me to take a few minutes to meditate and develop the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. And I'm not pointing this directly at you. It's the reason why that underlying notion always arises, is that's a very useful way to continue to ignore my own ignorance. Do you see that? So the world is too screwed up. How can I fix myself? Rather than if I fix myself, meaning I don't like even, I shouldn't even use the word fixed because I don't like the notion that I'm fixing a broken self. The world is so messed up. How can I take the time to heal myself, to gain understanding? Well, what else could be of any benefit? The world is stuck in wrong views. That's what's causing all of this. It's the competitiveness and the aggressiveness rooted in wrong views that cause individual conflict, me and you, and national conflict, parties against parties, ideologies against ideologies, and global conflict, nation against nation. And it's all rooted with trying to establish supremacy, whether it's I need to win this argument or I need to control the world. It's all the same thing. It's all rooted in ignorance. So again, it's such an important question. I'm glad you asked it. I hope you found my answer helpful. Good. And hope to see you next week. Anthony, good to see you.
I think a lot about what Margaret said. You know, and I try to put it in perspective because you think about it, was because of the turbulence in the 1960s that people like Joseph Goldstein, Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, Mark Epstein, and people like that went to India and learned about Buddhism and came back to America, you know, and sort of brought this to us. And it came out of those turbulent times, you know. So, and I think there are other times probably where it was a lot worse, right? During World War II, times. times like that, where I almost think that it's out of these really difficult times that a lot of greatness comes, and it's sort of cyclical in a way. You know, and it doesn't sustain itself. I try to look at that, you know. But like John's points are really great too. Nothing is perfect.
But there's always going to be that type of conflict in the world. It's going to be there. It's not. The first noble truth states that dukkha occurs. It's simply as a consequence of having a human life. Now, solving the ills of an ignorant society, I think is possible. I don't know that it's likely, though, because most of the strategies employed to solve social ills, most of them, not all of them, seem to create a kind of a backlash effect somewhere. And so the Buddha describes his own mind before his awakening as this feedback loop, because the world is caught in this feedback loop of compassion, but lacking the wisdom of how to carry that out. But there's interesting things that are taking place, and I'm not saying these are leading me to think that salvation is just around the corner or awakening. But look at all this stuff about the sexual predator stuff that's coming out now. That's not something new, and it's not something that's only been happening for the last 10 years. It's been happening since the beginning of humankind. Since the beginning that one aspect of a species thinks that it should and can have dominance over another aspect of that species, and that there's justification. That thought is a thought rooted in ignorance, isn't it? Ignorance of what? Ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So as we develop an understanding of Four Noble Truths, there's going to be a lot of people getting their hands slapped, and probably, I don't want to make a political statement, there's going to be a lot of people getting their hands slapped, hopefully a little bit more, not that I like to see people suffer, but I think a point needs to be made. When I hear about these things, and the icons of our society that are falling, it doesn't make me happy. It makes me deeply saddened. And I'm not talking about whether they're on the left or the right. But it also gives me hope, because we have to recognize the results of ignorance before we can do anything about it, don't we? So this idea of, and this gets back to what we were both saying, we have to understand, we have to have the proper view of suffering if we're not going to simply react over it and say, you know, shoot all the bastards or whatever else we want to do. Or even to create additional legislation. There's always been legislation about hurting other people. It hasn't stopped anybody, has it? Legislation can be a somewhat mindful response to what's occurring, but it's never going to solve our problems. No, if they would just make me emperor of the world, I'd make everybody study the Dhamma, but that's not going to happen. But the more and more people that develop a true awakening of the nature of suffering in their own minds and their own inner cause for reacting to the world in a competitive and aggressive way, the more people that understand that and let go of those wrong views, the more at peace the world will be. And that's something I really truly believe. The Buddha knew this too, but he never set himself up as a savior to the world. He never presented these teachings as salvific in any way. He simply said, if you want to develop a calm and peaceful mind, a mind of lasting equanimity, take to the Dhamma and awaken. Now, he was often asked by the kings and the other political leaders of his time for advice. And he taught them the Dhamma. And he had a profound effect on the violence of his time. And even after his time, again, sorry for going on so long, but this really, again, gets to the heart of the matter. About 250 years after the Buddha's passing was King Ashoka. Those of you may have heard of Ashoka, even the reservoir up in near Woodstock is named after him. King Ashoka was, up until that point, the most bloodthirsty and brutal and violent leader the world had ever seen. And he dominated all of northern India and most of southern India. That phrase, he put a head on the pike, or whoever the phrase is, came from King Ashoka. When he conquered a village or an area, He made a point of cutting off the heads and littering the countryside with heads on a pike so that everybody would know how powerful King Ashoka was. He came across the Buddha's teaching, developed the Dhamma, and awakened. And he never harmed another soul. So much so that there's still, what are they called? They're rock formations, but there's another word, all over northern India and even in Sri Lanka, that King Ashoka erected to promote the Buddha's teachings. They're still there today. Upon his awakening, King Ashoka did something that we're still trying to do today. He started universal health care out of great compassion and his great wealth. And then he went even further. He started universal veterinary care. From heads on a pike to let's take care of all sentient beings. That's how the Dhamma works. That's how it can solve the problems. That's why it's important to take to the Dhamma. As the Buddha would say, we take to the Dhamma like our hair is on fire. There's nothing more important. If we really care about each other, and even more, even in a more selfish way, if we really care about our own well-being, we'll take care of ourselves. We'll meditate and develop the Eightfold Path and develop that calm and peaceful mind that can spread. You know, I believe there is something, I won't get into Rupert Sheldon, but I'm getting into a lot. There is something about this idea of morphic resonance that one calm and peaceful mind can and does affect other peaceful minds. They've done studies of bringing meditation into very violent cities, and these studies have been done many times, not just once. And when a certain group of meditators, and it seems like about 1,000 folks, but there's been more and been less. When a certain number of meditators get together and meditate, any method, I'm not just talking about this method, when they do, the crime rate during their meditation session plummets. And even after, and that diminishing in the crime rate lasts for a certain period of time. They've proven that. So a calm and peaceful mind does have an effect on other people. Great question. Sorry for the long talk. Laura, good to see you.
Good to be here. The three marks of existence is just such a powerful teaching. Because, you know, it literally marks every moment of your existence. You can see these things in working. I can see how this not self appears and how the impermanence of that exists, and stress comes from that as well. And it's kind of taken aback by the paradox of impermanence and how impermanence causes stress but also relieves stress, and how that just keeps going around and around, and really understanding that, really understand, like, when you're in a moment of recognizing impermanence, letting go of clinging, craving, watching the dukkha leave, that the nature of life as impermanent, I mean, it just, you shift, you're, this not-self is not a self, so it shifts in every moment, and just the, I can't really articulate it, but, like, how impermanence itself kind of brings you back to the Eightfold Path, and renews the whole practice of the Eightfold Path in any given moment. But I don't know. I was also, you said something about continuity of compassion, and I just thought about how continuity obscures impermanence, and I was kind of trying to think about that in this context of what I'm trying to describe, which is not coming out properly. But if you get to that place of awakening, like, there's, because of impermanence, it's rolling. There's no self to hold on to. There's no Buddha nature. There's no identity with that. It's just a beautiful thing. And that's about it.
Laura, you articulated that beautifully. That
was so confusing. I don't even think what I was saying made any sense.
I think it did.
If I had before, it made some sense to me.
It did make sense. When we've let go of all self-referential views, when we're not clinging to self, to what's occurring in this moment and creating an identity over that, then we're just present for our life as life occurs in a mindful way, framed by the Eightfold Path. We're seeing things through right view. And so life is still flowing, but we're no longer creating a self out of what's occurring. We are simply a reference point to life and a mind resting in equanimity. We're not trying to influence what's occurring in any self-referential way. And again, think about the life of the Buddha. He lived the most important and, I think, effective and impactful life of any human being. And yet he did it without the need of a self-referential ego self, didn't he? He's just at peace with what's occurring.
Yeah, it's just really profound.
It is. It's the most
profound. My experience is that it's just I have to continually renew this idea, these ideas that you're presenting.
Yes.
And that it's not, there is not a continuity of compassion. I'm a nice person and I try to do good, but there's not, I'm interrupted by stress and by creating not self.
By eye making.
What's that?
Interrupted by eye making.
Right.
Yeah.
Eye making.
So. And that interruption leads to stress. So, initially, the process is just that, looking at yourself doing this. That's where the framework of the Eightfold Path is necessary to develop awakening, because you have to have a vehicle or a framework to recognize where you're doing it. And it is a constant process of coming back to right view meaning the entire Eightfold Path, recognizing where you're eye-making, where you're doing something that's rooted in a wrong or ignorant view, and not doing it. Practicing restraint. Remember, we talked a lot about restraint recently too. Recognizing it at that point. And it's within the environment of impermanence that suffering arises, but it's also within the environment of impermanence that awakening arises. That's what the Third Noble Truth speaks to, doesn't it? Cessation of the ongoing process of dukkha is possible. If it wasn't for impermanence, none of this would make any sense. It'd be useless. Impermanence is a problem, but understanding impermanence, like Kandana did and declared, understanding the nature of impermanence, which is really understanding the nature of dukkha, is the key to awakening, to full human maturity. And within that, understanding the eye-making, like you just described, is key. Thank you.
I never thought about it like that before. Like, it's because of impermanence that we probably strive harder to do right and be good, because otherwise we have an endless amount of chances and we don't care as much. I mean, like, all right, I can screw up today and tomorrow, but if you're on a timeline, you're probably more driven to accomplish, like, to be a better person in life and to do things.
Oh, yeah.
I actually thought of impermanence as being that pull that makes us good in some way.
When you look at it in that way, from right view, you understand the Buddha's last statement: impermanence and decay are relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. Get to it. You know, because we only, and nobody knows the story of Bahia, mindfulness of Bahia. Everybody laughs about it, but Bahia pleaded with the Buddha to give him his teachings now, because I don't know how much time I have or you have. And the Buddha finally relented and gave him a short teachings. Bahia awakened, and a short while later, he got trampled by a cow. Most everybody laughs when they hear that. It's a great sutta, one of the most important ones. But it points to none of us know, when the end is coming. So there's nothing more important. One of the few things, I won't beat up somebody else today. I've beat up enough people so far. Traditions. The reason why we're here, or the paramount reason, is to awaken. What else is more important? And we might as well do it in this life. And now, while I got a few years left to enjoy it. Greg, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. A lot's come up in just the last few minutes. And I had like a whole bunch of stuff, but I guess the one thing that I felt really identified with was it seems like, I guess it came from the Buddha nature idea, and how it sometimes it can feel selfish to strive for one's own awakening when there's so much other stuff going on in the world, and just the idea of finding balance there, and because you could be completely altruistic, and I even said to my friend one time in a conversation, I was like, oh, Buddha, you know, we were talking about bodhisattvas, and it's like, well, it seems kind of selfish, don't you think? You know, he sat under the tree, you know, he spent a lot of time just searching for his own enlightenment, when, you know, he could have been doing other things, but the teaching ended up spreading, and, you know, liberating how many countless other people. He was talking about reincarnation. So this, I guess, is a little separate. But I guess in those schools, the reincarnation is the bigger deal, which is part of the Bodhisattva thought process.
Yep.
That you know, you're going to do your best in this life, keep liberating people, come back, keep liberating people, come back, keep liberating people, and delay your separation from the wheel. But I mean, I've missed your talks on reincarnation, unfortunately, or I guess it was part of the karma talks.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've gotten out of it is that the Buddha's teachings, you know, as you said, we're concerned about this one specific life that we have right now and achieving liberation from suffering for the benefit of yourself and all beings. So that was a hard thing to get away from, the idea of the inner Buddha nature, that it was bound to arise in enough time, in enough lifetimes. And now I'm just rambling. I lost my thought, but yeah, the idea that if you were sitting there meditating, if someone was drowning, you wouldn't just sit there and be like, oh, I have to achieve my own salvation right now. That's what's more important than saving someone else. You would probably stand up and go save the person.
Hopefully.
But also, it would be madness to say, oh, I can't meditate now. Somebody might be drowning around the other side of the lake. And then you run around the lake looking for people drowning.
Yeah.
So there's a balance.
That's an act. Another way of looking at that would be mindlessness. It just is.
Right. So there's obviously a very clear, I thought that was a good example, and I was trying to find a way to get to that thought, so I did it.
You did it. Thank you. Thank you, Greg. The talks on karma and rebirth are on the website, too. It's important to understand the Buddha's distinction. Again, reincarnation was an idea rooted in the Vedas that the Buddha rejected and talked often about during his time to make a point that who cares who are you, or what you might be? You know, you could even, according to those teachings, you could be born as some kind of animal too, depending, or different realms. In some schools, there's infinite realms that you could. Who cares? Even if it's true, I want to awaken now, and that was a problem I had with it when I was part of those different schools. There's got to be a way to do it now, and I don't care about eons and eons in the future. And that's exactly what the Buddha said. So, thank you. Bob, welcome to our Sangha. How was your meditation this morning? And do you have any questions about our class?
I enjoyed it. Just a couple of things. I didn't, you know, I'm a meditator, but I really haven't done that much with Buddhism. But I've been reading a bunch, and this whole idea of not self, just it blew me away to think that you didn't have a self. More from not having external attachments, but basically the way you think, and the fact that maybe your thoughts really aren't your own. You think that they are, but they really may not be. And everybody defines himself by the way they think and the way they act, and that whole concept kind of got me thinking.
Yeah, that's an important, I would say even an entry to what the Buddha's teaching. It's our thoughts that, if they're rooted in ignorance, our thoughts are our thoughts, but if they're rooted in ignorance, they only create scenarios in our lives that are prone to confusion, delusion, and ongoing suffering. When we gain the ability, meaning right view, to see things as they are, then we're always living our life in a way that is peaceful and with a mind of equanimity. And so it really what the Buddha's teaching is a way to change our thinking from views and thinking rooted in wrong views to seeing the world through right view. And that's what the Eightfold Path is. So this meditation method that we use is called Shamatha Vipassana. On the website, there's a recording of this if you want to use it to guide your own meditations. On becoming-buddha.com, there's years of articles and recorded talks about just what we're talking about here. And I have a book that I've written, actually two books, but the newest one is called Becoming Buddha, which explains the entire context of what the Buddha taught and why he taught in a very specific way. So I'm glad you're here. Welcome to our sangha. Jen, good to see you.
Good to see you. I think the I heard you say all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation today, and for the first time I heard you say conditioned. I was missing that adjective in there.
Yeah, that's
it. And it kind of caught me, and I kind of was like, well, why do you even need to say conditioned? Can't we just say all things that arise are subject to cessation? Like, why make it complicated? Then I just kept talking, and I realized it's really pointing to I-making and letting go of my conditioning, or where I'm kind of subjugating what's happening in the world, or just making putting self-referential views on what's occurring.
Yeah.
And that kind of emphasizes saying all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation, kind of emphasizes your focus on how you're contributing to your own suffering.
Yeah, that's it.
So that's cool.
That's a profound understanding of all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. Kandana said those words in relation to Four Noble Truths, in the context of Four Noble Truths.
Right.
So you could say that all human life was conditioned on stars exploding. It's true. But it doesn't relate to the Dhamma. It's not important. You know, it's a useful bit of information. What Kandana was referring to, and what conditioned thinking relates to, is that suffering is conditioned from ignorance. So all conditioned things that arise, meaning the phenomena of suffering that arises, is conditioned by that initial ignorance. And Laura mentioned this too. And they also pass away. The relation to dukkha, the things that we attach ourselves to, arise and pass away. That's the nature of impermanence. Once we were talking, Lauren and I were talking about this a little earlier. When you truly understand the impermanent nature of all things, you'll stop attaching yourself to anything. It's just foolish to create an identity over something that's impermanent. You appreciate it while it's here, a nice piece of chocolate cake, but I don't need chocolate cake tomorrow to be happy. But I have it today. It's a nice, I enjoy it. All conditioned things that arise. Thank you. Becky, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here, John. I had a really good meditation here today. And I'm thankful for that. And I realized today, mostly listening to Laura and, well, listening to the talk, what I realized is that if you can separate yourself from your conditioned thinking and quit putting self-referential views on things that happen in your life, then there is no other way to live your life except in the moment. If you don't continue to build that self and that conditioned self, because you're doing it all the time.
Yep.
All the time.
It requires that type of vigilance.
It requires that diligence.
To keep the not self going.
And if you don't do that, then you can only live in the moment. You can only live in the moment.
Yes.
I just realized that today, that you can only live in the moment if you don't do that.
You are now Becca Condonna.
It's just like something that you could actually do.
Yeah.
It would be really far. And that's why we call it a practice.
Yeah. But you can actually do it. The Buddha taught a Dhamma for human beings to develop in this lifetime. It's not something... There's suttas where he says, if this was not possible, I wouldn't teach it. Why? Thank you. That's great. Debbie, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to be back. Hope everyone had a nice Thanksgiving.
We did. We missed you.
I know. I had visitors. Sometimes I can bring my visitors, but some visitors. I really just connected a lot to what Becky just said. And I really struggle with my mind. I've talked about this before, be present in my meditation, and I just get those glimpses here and there, and that's why I love coming and having the 30 minutes, because I get more glimpses, more periods of focus. But I've been good about my practice throughout everything, and I feel like I'm just, even though I don't have that full concentration that I want in my practice, that I am starting to see the results of it off the cushion more and more. And that's been really rewarding. Mm. Just to be less reactive and to be less with the conditioned thinking, be more present when my mind's always going, but when I'm in a situation, I feel like I'm less reactive, I'm more present. Chant non-resistance to the present moment, because when I want to resist, I'm hearing that inside now. I'm hearing that. This is it, be here, and be at peace with it. Or just don't react. That's good enough.
Yeah.
Even if I'm not fully in peace, at least if I'm not reacting, experience of what I'm trying to move towards, and that's good.
It is. Thank you, Debbie. It's important to recognize it. It's a secret. You have to come and see for yourself. You have to recognize the efficacy of what you're doing, and then to be able to do that, to recognize it and practice restraint, is only possible with ever developing concentration. In other words, your mind is concentrated enough to see the process of going on, and you practice restraint at that point. And the resistance is just another word for aversion. We have aversion. That's one of the three defilements that we talked about. So you're integrating the practice in a very practical way, which is how it's supposed to be done. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. It's just been wonderful. Looking at conditioned thinking and how my mind works, I like the word to judge. When you're judging, I think that is a sharp word, and that's how I can see my conditioned thinking when I'm judging this, mm-hmm. judging that. Judging in all sorts of ideas. So I look in my thinking if I'm judging, and to root out my conditioned thinking. And just lately, from the fire discourse that you did on Thursday, I really got the passion that we have to uphold the conditioned thinking that who we think we are, that is the passion that we're upholding all the time in our thoughts, words, and deeds, 24/7. In our Western culture, when we're taught to desire, you know, TVs and whatever, you know, it's almost, we're expected to desire things to maintain ourselves and to move forward in life or whatever it is, and it's really just another way, tweaking desiring another way, but it's all desire, and going down that path, it's the path of creating dukkha.
Yeah.
You know, you're just creating more self-identity, you know, you just self-identify with more stuff, which then, because of impermanence, it cannot be maintained. You know, it comes, you know, it's just your own way you identify yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it comes back to that, how you identify who you are. And then Tuesday night was on cutting the thistle, the cutting the barley.
Yeah.
You know, that you do, when you do see your own condition thinking, you do have to do something about it.
Yeah.
Which is the path. And once that barley is cut, it's cut. You know, you've got to keep it. You can't put it back, you can't. You know, that barley is cut, and you've got to cut your conditioned thinking. You have to do work to do that.
Yeah.
In your thinking, recognize it. When you see it, you have to cut it. And I think that's what the Sutra on Tuesday night was about. So just working on the work, you know, doing the work.
Yeah.
Meditating, thinking about the Buddha teachings. Eye-making, constant eye-making, try to diminish it, see it, diminish it, cut it. That's the work.
That's it. Yeah. Thank you. And awakening is not something that is imposed or granted because I've done certain things right or I'm the most wonderful so-and-so. I got to do the work. I got to recognize the problems in my own mind that create and lead to ongoing stress. Another way of just saying, looking at ignorance. Thank you. Brett, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thanks for your teaching.
My pleasure.
I've been meditating and trying to get back into a regular habit doing that. And I can only get to a certain point without coming to a group and hearing the Buddhist teachings and, you know, kind of being able to get over conditioned thinking and, you know, getting kind of coming in different angles and seeing it, how it comes in and being able to take care of it in different ways, and that's what the, you know, the Sangha or the your teachings do, so that's why I'm here, and thanks for being here.
I'm glad you're here. Yeah, it's so important. I would say nearly impossible to really develop the Buddha's teachings without a well-focused Sangha. In fact, that's what he taught. You know, this is the most important aspect of everything he taught, being part of a well-focused Sangha, which we're so fortunate to have what's developed here in Frenchtown. So, any other questions or comments about today's teaching? Okay, we are going to do, this time of year, we usually start a 12-week Truth of Happiness study, and we're going to do that again, but I think I'm going to do it right after the first of the year. And again, probably on Tuesdays and Saturdays. There's a series of talks that I want to get to first, and I'm hoping to start next week on the Anapanasati Sutta. That's been kind of a year in the making, and I'm just about ready for it, so. Right after that, we'll start another Truth of Happiness series. So we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. Metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.